I'm Michael Cathcart on RN. You are so very, very welcome to Books and Arts. Today, a show about finding your place in the world. The Perth Theatre Company's place in the world is looking a bit shaky. It has cancelled the rest of its season due to money woes.
It's a great shame, and it's something that I think that we should really be doing absolutely everything in our power to stop from happening, because if we lose another theatre company, that's just quite dire for WA, I think.
And the English writer Catherine Rundle says that her favourite place in the world is on rooftops looking down. That's the setting for her bold new book for children. And you'll meet photographer James Tyler, an Australian of Maori descent, whose work is about his uncertain connection to the land of the long white cloud. But first,
like a virgin, hey, touched for the very first time. Like a virgin, with your heartbeat next to mine.
Yes, with your heartbeat next to mine, we're about to take a journey through six Australian bedrooms, six teenage bedrooms actually, for stories about growing up, going out, losing a parent, losing your virginity, and somehow keeping it all together. Six Bedrooms is a collection of short stories by Tegan Bennett Daylight.
There is a part of your life, I now realise, in which you're so clean and fresh-looking that you can wear the oldest clothes and still look pretty. I noticed this stage passing after my son was born. I still went into second-hand shops. I was good at finding the right things, running my eyes along the rows of dresses, pulling something out with red in it, a bold pattern, a geometric neck. One day, with my son in his pram, I tried one of these dresses on, and I looked as though I'd been born when the dress was made. No more a doll, a gorgeous baby doll dressed up in pretty doll's clothes. And I no longer had that strong, eager, possible look that had made it hard for me to meet my own eyes in the mirror. When I was 15, I went to a party given by one of the girls in my year, the kind of party everyone was asked to. She had a new record which we hadn't heard. It was Madonna, Like a Virgin. I didn't like it much. I was given to anachronistic musical passions inspired by my parents or my older brother. The Beatles, of course, an Australian recording of the Rocky Horror Show with Reg Livermore and Kate Fitzpatrick. I stopped at the doorway of Katie's sunken living room and looked down at the girls writhing on the carpet. Of course I didn't know what it meant, like a virgin. No, I knew what it meant, but I didn't know what it was to be reclaimed like that, to find a love so fresh that you felt like you were doing it for the first time. Doing it for the first time was something I wished could happen while I took leave of my body. I wanted a beautiful anaesthetist, a drug to make me swoon. I watched the girls dancing like Madonna, a sort of shiver from top to bottom running through their bodies like a ripple of water.
Tegan Bennett Daylight reading from her story, Like a Virgin. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Nice work. How do you like a Virgin now? What did you think when it came on?
It was really funny. You know, I haven't heard it for such a long time. I was not a Madonna sort of a girl. I was much more kind of an Elvis Costello listener, shall we say, than a Madonna girl.
You're a sophisticated girl.
Oh, that's a very nice thing to say and not true at all.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a lovely reflection on getting older too. The idea that when you go into an op shop and you put the thing on that once looked so groovy on you, suddenly you think, actually, I just look like an older person in some old clothes.
Yeah. And of course, you know, when you're young, you don't realise that you look good in the old clothes either. My mother always used to say, beauty belongs to the young, and I never understood it until now.
No. Now, will you suddenly reach a stage where you realise how true it is? So this goes on to be a story told by a girl who we get to know through your book as Tasha. Who's Tasha?
She's my alter ego, I think. I've been thinking about this a fair bit. She is the person who says the things that I never had the courage to say when I was a growing up girl, when I was a difficult teenager. So some of the situations she gets herself into are similar to ones that I've got myself into, but where I said nothing, she always says something and sees if she can make it worse.
So this is the classic manoeuvre when someone tells you a story about how they came up with that really great remark, that withering comeback, and you know they really didn't say it. They're just inventing it after the event.
Exactly.
You've
right.
You've written a whole book like this.
That is so exactly right. Tasha is l'esprit d'escalier in person.
Yeah, well done. All right. She's not the only storyteller in this book, we should say. She's in four of the stories, is that right? Four of
That's
them?
That's right.
Four
yeah.
of them. There are ten in all. So just sticking with Tasha for a moment, I was really struck by how much alcohol was a feature of her home life. Her mum likes a drink.
Yeah, she does. It's interesting, isn't it? Neither of my parents are big drinkers, but my grandparents were quite big drinkers. And also, you know what, it was just a big feature of my teenagehood. It was around all the time and it was noticeable. It was noticeable. And it seemed important to give this mother something difficult to do.
You mean it was noticeable among the kids as alcohol, or you mean their parents seemed to be?
Noticeable among the kids, but also among the parents, yeah.
Okay.
I think I noticed a lot of drinking. And there's a scene in one of the stories in which the main character opens a fridge door and sees it full of nothing but champagne. And that's a strong memory from my teenagehood.
So, Tegan, in that first story, the one you just read from, Tasha is off to a party and she's not all that enthusiastic about going to the party. It's Tasha's mum who's enthusiastic. And she's not at all the cautious mum that we normally encounter in stories like this. Perhaps you should just tell us, we won't go through all the stories, obviously, but just tell us a little of what happens at that party.
At the Like a Virgin party?
Yeah.
Tasha goes with her best friend, Judy, and they are outcasts because of their sort of difficulties. Judy is overweight and an opera singer or an opera singer in the making, and Tasha's just a difficult girl. So when they go, they know there won't really be a place for them. But they go hoping to find a place with the boys they're in love with. Tasha's in love with a boy called Raffaello, who she's been sitting next to in maths, and Judy is in love with the best-looking, nicest boy in the whole school, so there's no luck there either. And Tasha makes a proposal to Raffaello that he laughs at in front of everybody, and Judy drinks so much that she nearly passes out and has to be carried out of the party.
She needs to be assisted home, yes.
She does.
Now, is it Judy that's got the Titian hair?
It's Judy that's got the Titian hair.
Tell us about Titian. This is Titian, yeah, as in the Renaissance painter.
That's right.
Tell us about Titian hair.
Judy is large. Both Judy and Tasha, at that stage of their lives, think she's fat, but they come to realise afterwards that she's really just a large girl. And what she feels is her only strong feature is this long, beautiful red gold hair. And because they're quite educated girls, they're readers and they're lookers and they're listeners. The idea to them of somebody having Titian hair, you know, that fabled red gold hair, they focus on it and they think of it as Judy's great asset, basically.
But they're imagining being painted, aren't they?
Yes. The boy that Judy has a particular crush on paints. He's doing his HSC art and he paints. And her ambition, her private ambition, is to be painted naked by him with her Titian hair falling over her breasts.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a nice thing to do with your life.
Yeah, why not?
So here you are, Tegan. We know you as a novelist. Here you are writing short stories. What's motivated you to try your hand at short stories?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I was in search of a new voice. I was in search of something that had more energy and urgency. I wanted to do something also about teenagehood. And for some reason, the novelistic voice didn't seem to cover that as well. I seemed to find more energy in the short story for the teenage voice.
Let's talk a bit more about what voice means. What are you evoking when you talk about voice?
It's a really hard thing to define, but I'll give it a shot for you. I think it's like a voice is a bit like an engine in a story. It's the thing that gets everything moving. And my feeling is, after long reflection, that while voice is hugely important in a novel, especially in a first-person novel like Catcher in the Rye or something like that, the novel is also really about plot and about accumulation of event. You actually will give a novel more of a chance to have less of an urgent voice because you're sort of interested to see what happens next. And because you're holding a lot of pages in your hand, you know something is going to happen. Whereas with the short story, you might not be so willing to read it unless it has a kind of urgency, a sudden voice, a voice that sort of captures you straight away. So I think that's really my main reason for turning to the short story form. For some reason, that compression of form made it possible, or made it necessary, in fact, for me to use this more urgent voice.
Now, that makes real sense to me, because when I read a short story, I realise, as you're talking, the first thing I ask is, who is telling me this story? And often the writer will play with you a bit. You know, not tell you even whether it's a boy or a girl, or and gradually you'll try to suss out who it is who's talking. Whereas in a novel, you can often have the experience that the storytelling is coming to you in the passive mode, that you are being told a story, if you see what I mean. The story's just coming to you.
Yeah, and you sort of settle down with the characters, don't you? It's like, oh, well, you know, they were born here and they did such and such. There's no space to do that in the short story. And in fact, you'll be interested to know that amongst my good writing friends, I started a private project and I named it the Betterment Project. And in the Betterment Project, which was obviously just making things better, I had to go back to the beginning of every short story to see if I had made the voice powerful enough to seize the reader straight away. Because I'm conscious that short stories aren't always everybody's cup of tea, and you really need to be able to grab hold of a reader pretty quickly.
Yes, because you're competing with other forms of distraction. I mean, I could go and put on the radio or read something in the paper or put on a record or something, or a CD,
that's
I
right.
suppose.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So you do want to feel right at the start that this is someone I want to be with, or someone who's appalling me, you know, someone
yes,
who is just
right.
ghastly,
that's
or
right.
who's this going to turn out to be? But somehow they've really got to get under your skin. We're getting to know the Sydney writer Tegan Bennett Daylight, who's in with her new book, which is called Six Bedrooms, and it's 10 stories that take us through the bedrooms of various teenagers. So what sort of responses have you been getting from readers? Are people recognising their own adolescence in the stories you're telling?
Oh, look, Michael, it's just been absolutely fantastic. I've had responses from all over the world, including my kindy teacher, I thought you'd like to know, and people I don't know and people I do know. And the thing that I'm hearing more and more than anything else is a couple of people have said to me, it's as though you were writing my life. Which is so funny, because I felt so alone while I was a teenager, and it's so funny to have found the universal. So I'm getting this really powerful response in a way that I've almost never seen before from readers. It's really exciting.
Maybe most teenagers are outsiders. Maybe that's why Holden Caulfield's so popular.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So you spend all this time in your teenagehood thinking, it's just me, it's just me. They're all doing a good job of this. I'm doing a terrible job. And then you get into adulthood and you realise everybody thinks they're a failure.
And when you think about your reader, these readers who are writing to you from all over the world, well, do you think about them? Do you have a sense of who they are? What kind of broader context your work fits into? What do they like, your readers?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I'm really conscious of them once I've finished a book, but while I'm writing, it's probably a bit too much to say I'm thinking of them. But I do think of everything that I write as being like a letter, and there are a few people that I'm writing letters to, some of my writing friends, including Charlotte Wood and Tim Winton. I'm writing to them. I'm writing a bit to my husband. I'm writing to myself. But the broader public, I think about them when I have to sit down and edit the book and make sure that it makes sense to them.
Is that a big part of the process, the editing process?
Yeah, it was really good with this book as well. I had a young editor who was really tough on me. I'd never written a book of short stories before, and putting one together, you have to make a certain kind of plot sense that you didn't think you had to make because it was a collection. But she showed me how to kind of draw a through line through the stories. It was a really, really interesting process.
And when you're writing, are you working in a kind of inspired isolation, or are you in contact with those writer friends you were talking about, Charlotte Woods and Tim Winton? Are you sending stuff back and forward among writing friends?
It's sort of, I have a couple of different kind of approaches. Well, with Charlotte and my friends Lucinda Holdforth, Eileen Naseby and Vicky Hastrich, we meet and talk about our work, and sometimes I'd read stuff to them. Tim is a friend by correspondence, so I try not to bother him with drafts of my work, but we sort of just talk. We talk about reading a lot when we're writing to each other.
Tegan, I reckon when you're writing, whether you're writing fiction or non-fiction, it's really important to have someone you can share your work with at that stage when you're not yet confident that it's any good. Because if you hold your writing back, you say, oh, I can't show anybody this, it's crap, you know, I can't possibly air it. Once you finally feel, oh, gosh, I've got to show it to someone because it's due at the publisher in a month's time, it's too late for anyone to say anything constructive. All they can say is, oh, Tegan, it's really great, I really love it. They can't actually say, yeah, but the stories are in the wrong order and do you really need that character there? Maybe you should take that character out. They can't do that because they know if they've got any sensitivity, it's too late.
That's right, that's right. And I have to say that I did spend a bit of time reading some of these short stories out to Vicky, Eileen, Charlotte and Lucinda. And what I loved about reading to them in particular was that they picked up on Tasha very quickly. And we spent time talking about her as though she was real. She seemed real to me and she seemed to seem real to them as well. So we would often say, well, what's she up to now? What's she going to do next?
Right. So even though there are other stories told by other narrators, one of them is told by a boy. Actually, it's not told by the boy. You didn't actually decide to do him in the first person, did you? He's a third person story, that story about the boy.
That's
Why was
right.
that?
That's interesting, isn't it? Not so much a conscious decision, but I think it's probably because slightly more difficult to inhabit the voice of a young man for me. But also, he's a boy who's at a distance from himself. He doesn't know himself very well at all. He's not very self-aware. And so the third person seemed to really work for him there.
Yes, I suppose that's a reason for doing it. I mean, like all of them, all of the people in this book, he's very bewildered and anxious about sex. No one's actually dying to sort of jump into it, are they? They're all a bit sort of both fascinated and nervy, yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure the world is populated by confident, happy teenagers having fulfilling sexual relationships. Just wasn't my thing.
But you never met any of them. So as we wind up, Tegan, you've got a little girl yourself, Alice. How old is she?
She's 14, actually, not so little.
Oh, well, she's about to embark on this world herself. Are you, has she read the book?
She hasn't yet. No, I'm not sure what she'd think of it, actually. Some of the stuff is probably a little adult-oriented for her taste. I might just leave it to her to choose when she wants to. Yes. She's read my kids' books.
You know, she feels little at 14. There's only like 18 months to go before she doesn't feel little anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
It's all about to descend upon you. Tegan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to chat.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
Tegan Bennett-Daylight. Her book is called Six Bedrooms. It's published by Vintage. And I really enjoyed it. I think you'll really like this one. This is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart. Money. Yes, money, 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 money troubles. Money troubles have hit the Perth Theatre Company in Western Australia and it's made a very drastic decision. It's decided to cancel all its shows for the rest of the year. So the company says that falling sponsorship and lower than expected audience numbers have meant that they just can't go ahead with the rest of the season. So the much publicised production of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men's been called off. That production was set to star Terminator Genesis actor Jay Courtney. So the Perth Theatre Company is saying that this, well, they hope this is just a temporary recess that they're on. I wonder what this setback means for the wider theatre community in Perth. Perth's Blue Room Theatre often sees its performers take their next step at the Perth Theatre Company. The Blue Room's executive director is Kerry O'Sullivan. She's speaking to Claire Nichols.
Perth Theatre Company has always been incredibly supportive of Blue Room Theatre and vice versa, we've been incredibly supportive of them. The shows that are actually that happen at the Blue Room Theatre will generally tend to be independent theatre makers and making it a very small-scale show. What has happened is sometimes Perth Theatre Company will see those shows and then they'll see that the independent artists are ready for a next-level opportunity and can actually take them along and then give them higher production values and tour them. I mean, certainly that happened with The Adventures of Alvin Sputnik, Deep Sea Explorer, which was an amazing success and is still touring after 7 years now, I think, yeah. 6 years, yeah.
That was a brilliant show. And you see those names, Tim Watts, who made that show, and other names, you see them start here and then you do see them pop up in the PTC program.
Yeah, yeah. And even Zoe Pepper, who's amazing, does Side Pony Productions. Her show didn't start here, but, you know, she has done shows here in the past, and she did a wonderful show in this season of Perth Theatre Company. And also you have Ian Sinclair, who has done work here as well. You know, like, these are artists who are ready for next-level opportunities, and we only provide, like, quite a small opportunity, but it's a really important one for the development of artists. But if they want to keep going further and keep pushing their work, then they need other places to develop and get new work on.
Perth Theatre Company has blamed falling sponsorship for its decision to cancel the rest of the season. You must know, how hard is it to attract corporate sponsorship in Western Australia?
Yeah, we've had not very much success ever, really, in attracting corporate sponsorship at the Blue Room. I know that corporates really do love to have, you know, that State Theatre Centre experience and have that, you know, wonderful sort of zhuzhi crowd and be able to have the mixing beforehand and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, places like Black Swan or the Ballet, they're perfect fits for corporates. And, you know, for us, you know, we're concerned with the experimental and the developmental and really about telling the story of excellence before it's excellence, you know, like the training and the development of it.
One of the things that Perth Theatre Company pointed to when they talked about the decision to cancel the rest of the season was saying that the difficulty in attracting sponsorship may be related to the struggling WA economy at the moment. Are you witnessing that it is harder to reach out to the corporate world at this particular point in time?
Look, I think that we've almost but given up on reaching out to corporates, and certainly with the downturn in resources boom, etc., we haven't really done that at all. Instead, you know, we've kind of looked at philanthropy and had donation drives, and we actually have like a lot of small donors who will give, you know, what they can because they believe in the Blue Room Theatre and what it does for artists. And I think that, you know, even when there was a resources boom, the people weren't especially interested in investing their money in the arts necessarily. And, you know, I think, yeah, that's a great shame of Western Australia.
Looking at all this context and economic downturn, the struggle for sponsorship, is it surprising to you to hear that PTC has decided to cancel the rest of its season?
Yeah, look, I was really surprised and really saddened. I do know, obviously, that it hasn't been a great climate for them, particularly in terms of corporate sponsorship and trying to attain that corporate sponsorship. I guess, hoped that they would be able to make that with, you know, such a big name like Jai and with a fantastic, wonderful, big show like Of Mice and Men. You know, I could see that that would be a nice thing for a corporate to jump onto as well.
All of this plays out against this backdrop of the shake-up of Commonwealth arts funding. You were really outspoken about this at your season launch last week. What are your concerns about this new model?
My concern is that it deeply affects individual artists as well as the small to medium sector. And both Perth Theatre Company and myself, or the Blue Room Theatre, is within the small to medium sector. We currently get funding from Australia Council, and we know that the funding pool which we are funded through is going to be greatly reduced. And so we don't know whether or not we've got funding beyond 2016. And we're not the type of organisation that George Brandis is going to be looking for with his National Program of Excellence in the Arts either.
How do you know that?
He's looking for people who have corporate sponsorship and are leveraging that corporate and philanthropic dollar. And he's also looking at excellence and fine arts. And we really do, you know, try to be the place that excellence is forming rather than arrived.
How do you feel about the health of the WA arts scene at the moment?
I think that the independent theatre practitioners are just some of the best in Australia, and they are so talented and they're crying out for next level opportunities. And I think that it's wonderful if we could try and somehow encourage and nurture those artists.
We have already seen the collapse of one major theatre company in WA with Deck Chair Theatre a couple of years ago. How foreboding do you think that might be for PTC?
Look, I don't know anything more than what has been reported on in the news in terms of being able to predict. But at the same time, I'm incredibly concerned that, you know, Perth Theatre Company having to cancel their season. I think that it's a great shame, and it's something that I think that we should really be doing absolutely everything in our power to stop from happening, because if we lose another theatre company, that's just quite dire for WA, I think.
Yeah, that's a very sad development in Perth. On RN, that's Kerry O'Sullivan, the Executive Director of the Blue Room, talking to Books and Arts Perth producer Claire Nichols.
Let me tell you now, when I come home feeling tired and weak, I go up where the air is fresh and sweet. I get away from the hustling crowd and all that rat race noise down in the street. All the rooms, the only place I know.
Yes, On the Roof's the only place I know. The Drifters were the original 1962 version of Carole King's hit song, Up on the Roof. Well, the joys and perils of being up on the roof are at the heart of an award-winning children's book called Roof Toppers, in which a girl called Sophie searches for her mother across the rooftops of Paris. And I have to tell you, there is a real buzz around this book, real excitement. The author is Catherine Rundell, and she joins us now from London. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
Now, I know that you know what you're talking about, because I'm looking at a picture of you on the marvellous internet, and you're balanced on the hip of a rooftop, the rooftop of All Souls College in Oxford, and you haven't got a care in the world. You're up on the roof.
That's true. I feel happier on rooftops than anywhere else in my life. I think something about being up high and being able to see the world and being close to the sky, and, you know, no one ever asks you to do any work when you're on a rooftop. It's
right.
Just wonderful.
Do you sing Carole King at the top of your voice? Or?
I mean, I will from now on, definitely.
The other rooftop song is Chim Chimney, Chim Chimney, Chim Chim Chimney, isn't it? From Mary Poppins.
Exactly. I loved that film so much. Obviously, you know, deep influence on my work. You right. can see it.
Dick Van Dyke leaping around above the chimneys with that absolutely implausible accent.
Exactly, that fantastic Cockney accent.
So what's the feeling like when you're up there among the spires and gargoyles? Who are you when you're up there?
I think you just get to be a slightly bolder version of yourself, and you get to see things that you wouldn't usually see. So if you climb around the Oxford rooftops, you discover things like which gargoyles are growing moss on their tongues and which have got this sort of hat of grass that's growing. And you can, you know, when I was younger, I used to put lipstick on them to show that I'd been there. And you can see visions of people that you wouldn't usually see. Crowds suddenly look very beautiful, and light at night looks so beautiful.
I'm not sure you should be putting lipstick on a gargoyle. It's probably corrosive lipstick.
It washes off.
It just washes off, does it? All right. Yeah. Now, last year here on the show on Books and Arts, we spoke to the crime writer Val McDermott about her book, her novel, which is called The Skeleton Road. And this features roof walking on university rooftops, no less. Is this a thing?
Well, I think it is. It dates from quite a long way ago. There was a group called the Roof Climbers of Cambridge who used to go around and scale, you know, the biggest cathedrals in Cambridge. And there's all these amazing pictures of them dressed in, like, you know, cravats and braces and very sensible trousers hanging off, you know, 100-metre drops. Absolutely amazing.
I'm not sure whether I think that's amazing or I think it sounds like a lot of rich twits misbehaving in Cambridge. But not that you're a rich twit. I'm not putting you in that company at all. Let me hasten to add, Kate. So let's talk about your novel. So your hero or your heroine is Sophie. Who is she? Just set her up for us.
So Sophie is a girl who is found floating in a cello case in the middle of the ocean as a ship goes down. And she doesn't know anything about herself, but she's taken in by this sort of eccentric guardian. And the thing she wants most is to find her mother, who she is sure she saw floating away, you know, not dying as the ship went down. And so she goes on this adventure. And the things about her are that she loves music and that she loves adventure. And those are the sort of two things that shape her life.
And they're in London. Well, it starts off in London.
That's right.
The time of the novel is a bit unclear to me. There are still horses and carriages. When are we doing this, do you think?
Well, it's sort of deliberately slightly unclear. You know it's after 1900 because the Eiffel Tower is built. But I would say 1908-ish.
1908-ish.
Yeah.
Both specific and vague at the same time. Okay, 1908-ish. And as you say, Sophie has this conviction, really, that her mother is out there. So she goes on a quest with this man who's rescued her. That's Charles, who's a rather loving and unconventional fellow who brings her up with great care and a good deal of eccentricity. And they go to Paris. Now, what's the clue that leads them to Paris?
So they discover a label in the inside of a cello case that gives an address of a Paris cello maker. So they had always assumed that the mother was English, and they suddenly think, well, what if she's French? What if Sophie is in fact a French baby but didn't know because she couldn't speak when she was first found? And so they go, and they go to Paris, and Paris is a city I've always loved, and Paris is a city with the most beautiful rooftops, I think, in Europe. They're just exquisitely lovely, all these sort of crenellations. So they go, and then when they're there, they discover this gang of children who live secret lives up on the rooftops of Paris.
Yes, it's marvellously interesting
out
there.
And that's a sort of secret world.
So what's the gap between when she's found by Charles floating in the cello case and when they head to Paris? How many years are there, do you think?
It's probably about 10 years, I reckon. Sophie is, I mean, I know how old she is, but I quite like it to leave a little bit open. In that, I think it's nice for children to be able to reckon that the hero is their own age. So, you know, 10 to 12-ish, 13-ish.
The concept of ish turns out to be quite important in your cosmology.
Exactly.
Okay. So off she goes to the rooftops of Paris, these lovely rooftops, and she meets a Mathieu there. And there are some kids up there who are a bit dangerous too.
Right, exactly. So I wanted it to be a world that wasn't safe. It had to be something where there was an edge, a kind of spark of danger. Because I think in books, especially in children's books, danger is a thing that galvanizes them. So there's both the children who we love, who are called the rooftoppers, and then there's another rival gang called the Guerriers, who live on the railway station, and they are sort of bitter, mean fighters, and they just want to take over the city.
On RN, this is Books and Arts, and my guest is roof walker and author Kate Rundle, and we're talking about her new children's book, Roof Toppers. And this lovely sound is cellists from the Calgary Orchestra playing themes from Fauré's Requiem. So Fauré's Requiem comes into the story played on a cello.
It does, yeah. For me, I think that's one of the most beautiful pieces of music there is. And I think the cello is this most fantastic instrument. Yeah. I think it sounds like being in love. It's just beautiful.
I'm glad you like Fauré's Requiem. I think it's my favourite piece of classical music. It's the most consoling, joyous, redemptive piece of music to be played at a time of death and sorrow.
Exactly. It puts hope in the blood.
It does. Yeah. So hope in the blood is what what Sophie feels when she hears this sound.
Yeah, exactly. So the sound, she suddenly thinks, you know, it rings a bell, and she thinks perhaps that's the noise that will lead me to her mother, because she's heard from a man who knew her that she used to play Fauré's Requiem, played slow and then played double time so that you could dance to it. And so it's supposed to be sort of a sort of symbolic trope whereby you make joy out of sadness, that the Requiem is played at death, but if you can also get love from it.
Yes. I did try speeding that up, Kate, but it just sounded like Pixies. It didn't work at all, so we just had to go with it in regular time.
Thank you for trying.
So Paris does lend itself to these stories about subcultures. I mean, I know that in Paris there's a lot of urban folklore about people who live in the catacombs and the tunnels under Paris and never emerge. And there's a lovely film, a 1985 film called Subway, starring Christopher Lambert, about the people who live in the underground of Paris. Have you ever seen this film?
No, but I should. That sounds remarkable.
Directed by Luc Besson. It's fantastic. So they're the exact opposite of your mob. These people live in the in the metro, in the underground, the metro, and in tunnels and whatnot that run off the metro, while your group are right up there in the sky, but they are sort of mirror images of each other. So it is a kind of whimsical world that you've discovered. Why is it important to you, this world that you've discovered? What does it represent to you?
I think one of the things that makes children's fiction work best is when it has this idea of a world that runs alongside our own, but is only available to certain people. So if you think of Harry Potter, the idea that you might be a wizard without knowing it, and then the wizards live alongside us, and with Narnia, this world that you can access, you know, through a wardrobe, and with Philip Pullman's Northern Lights, the idea that these worlds are interlinked. And I wanted it to be a similar sense that there is more than we know. And that these worlds, if you have faith and if you are tough and if you are bold, you might have access to. And that was, I think, something that I think resonates quite strongly with children. And it was something I wanted to inject into the story. And also, I just wanted to write about rooftops, that I just really like being up high.
Yeah, no, we've got that. We know that about you, Kate. But I think you've really nailed it. That for children, this idea that there is a world which with bravery and with belief you can go to, and perhaps a world that ordinary adults can't get access to. That's very appealing.
Exactly. And if you think of it, we try to recreate it when we're children by doing things like building tree houses that we don't let our parents in, or, you know, having a secret language that only exists between siblings. I think children do need to be allowed to shut adults out sometimes so that they can live intense lives as children.
Yes, I used to have an intense world that was created simply by putting a blanket over the card table. And sitting underneath.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound very intrepid now that I say it out loud, but it seemed quite good at the time. I've just been reading a lovely piece that you wrote in the London Review of Books recently, Kate, where you said, as a child I wanted to fly on dragons, and you go on the vast, brutal beauty of the Battersea Power Station is the closest I'm going to get. I don't want to leave the listener with the impression that you only walk on the roofs of Oxford colleges. You have been to other places as well. Will you tell us briefly about the charms of the Battersea Power Station?
Oh, that was absolutely amazing. Battersea is this beautiful sort of, it is brutalist, but it also has these crenellations that kind of evoke cathedrals, and you don't see it from the ground. But I went one night, to be honest, slightly illegally, and climbed up the outside of it with a friend. And
we should just explain that it's right in the heart of London, and it's this enormous, imposing structure that's now disused, and I think is going to be repurposed as apartments or something, isn't it?
That's right. It's going to be apartments and yoga studios and things. But at the moment, it's just these four great smokestacks. And what's really amazing about them is that if you climb up them, you can find your way into the smokestacks. And on the inside, they're lined with this beautiful grey-green iridescent tiling, which is insane. There is no reason to put tiling on the inside of a smokestack that is that beautiful. But Giles Gilbert Scott just believed in invisible beauty. And I think you only discover things like that if you go out and find them.
Well, it's a lovely piece of writing, that piece that you did for the London Review. We might put a link to that on our own website here at Books and Arts. So what are the next heights that you plan to scale, Kate?
I'm not sure. There are so many that would be wonderful to try. Maybe other cities, maybe the Empire State or something like that. But I think there's a few in London that the moment scaffolding goes up something, then you know that it's going to be disused for a bit and you know you're safe to give it a shot.
It's an invitation to try. And what about literary heights? Where do your ambitions lead you in that regard? I know you've got a PhD to finish.
I do. But then after that, I'd like to keep writing for this kind of age group for a while, the sort of 9, 12, 13 age group. I think that's a great moment to write for, because kids at that age, the books they read get under their skin. They remember them forever. They're very good readers. They read with passion. So I think I'm going to stick there for a while.
Good on you, Kate. It's been lovely to meet you. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kate Rundle there. Her novel is called Rooftoppers. It's published by Faber and Faber, and it's done very well. It won Waterstone's Children's Book Prize and also the Blue Peter Book Prize, which are two top awards in the UK. And I really do recommend that article, the one she wrote about climbing the Battersea Power Station. It's a lovely piece of writing. There's a link to it on our website on RN. This is Books and Arts. Next up, photography.
Well, Hawaki is the Maori idea of a distant ancestral homeland. It's both a spiritual and a physical place. And this concept is deeply embedded in the latest photographic work by James Tyler, who's an Australian artist of Maori descent. And James really likes to experiment with photography. He's quite an artisan, actually. He's learnt the techniques of daguerreotype and ambrotype, and sometimes he incises his photographs with circular or rectangular voids. He's even ripped his landscapes. In the case of this show, these are black and white photographs of mountains on the South Island of New Zealand. The show is called Aotearoa Mai Hawaki, and it's a meditation on belonging despite the impact of colonisation and migration. Daniel Browning is asking the questions.
I'm James Tyler, and I'm a photo-based artist. I make work based on my heritage, which is Aboriginal Maori and Anglo-Australian with Scottish, Irish, English, Norwegian and Dutch heritage. This work is Aotearoa Mai Hawaki. It looks at the concept of Hawaki, which is the homelands or where your ancestors come from. My family moved here from New Zealand in the 30s and I feel a connection to New Zealand, but at the same time Australia's home for me, and I was looking at the word Aotearoa, which means the land of the long white cloud, which I always feel like I have a connection to this place, the land of the long white cloud. And when I was a kid, I kind of envisaged the mountains touching the clouds. And so I approached this series with the idea that I would photograph the mountains touching the clouds. But spending time in New Zealand, I realised the place was familiar through an ideology of a place, just knowing this is where my ancestors come from, but really not actually having that because I grew up in Australia. So because of like the colonisation process, I decided that I would tear the land, which I don't actually have a proper connection to, but I have a connection to this ideology of the mountaintops and the clouds. So, yeah, the images are digital prints, but originally shot on film, and then I've teared the bottom of the landscape out.
I guess there is a kind of, I don't want to say violence apparent in that tearing process. What's that tearing process amount to in this work?
I guess,
does it allude to some kind of loss or dispossession?
Yeah, well, I guess it kind of basically looks at the colonisation process and being displaced. And our family is displaced not directly because of colonisation, but it came about in a way because of. My great-grandmother married my English great-grandfather, and then they, just after having my grandmother, they migrated to Melbourne and then later to Narrawong, which is in Western Victoria, to set up a sheep farm. But yeah, basically they came to Australia for new opportunities. But that process could only come about because of colonisation. So really it was just a metaphor for that disconnect to place. For me, it's probably a gentler rip than an aggressive rip, I guess. But, it's posed a lot of problems, I think, not having that connection to Aotearoa. So basically I've just set up, or I'm trying to make my own identity here in Australia by making this series.
There is a kind of very lyrical sense of loss in these images. And it's very interesting that you say these images, which are so clearly of the South Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand, that they evoke, I guess, a sense of belonging in Australia, is that?
Yeah, well, that's really what I'm trying to highlight, that I no longer actually have that physical connection to Aotearoa. It's just really an ideology, and my physical connection is to this space and this place. And, I feel as I'm doing work about landscape, the more that I'm starting to understand how history runs through that narrative. And the same does to an extent in New Zealand, but not in the same way it does to Australia from just growing up here and just travelling around. I've lived in most places in Australia, so I feel just an overriding connection to here, not Aotearoa, which is, I only went to Aotearoa when I was 22. So, and my dad hadn't been there, and my grandmother hadn't been there since she was a kid. Although we're not 100% sure that she was born in New Zealand or born in Melbourne, but her mother is definitely Maori from Aotearoa. But we just don't know where that disconnection is. And it's an interesting one.
I'm reminded of the documentary photography of Ansel Adams, who spent a lot of time in photographing places like Yosemite, the wild, parts of the United States. Any, are you looking to anyone in particular when you line up these mountains? Ansel Adams, does he mean anything to you?
Well, I don't think necessarily Ansel Adams, but I do get that connection through landscape. And maybe indirectly have been influenced by someone who's probably influenced by Ansel Adams. But yeah, Mark Adams, Pākehā photographer, I saw some of his work just before I left to do this trip and do these photographs. And I also met him along the way, kind of just accidentally. I just was sitting next to him in a conference and I didn't have any idea that it was him, and we were talking about landscape, and then it clicked to me, and then I had to ask him what his last name was. But I think there's a level of his photography has slightly influenced just knowing about his work. It wasn't a direct reference to his work, that I, you know, subconsciously thinking back, that's probably one of the influences I've got is through Mark Adams' work. Of a lot of the places that Cook had been to, he'd photographed. And, you know, I was also looking at Decookalization, a series where I looked at renaming places that were named after Cook, but in the traditional names. So I was definitely in that headspace, and I talked to Mark about that, and he influenced that series a little bit more.
I missed Decookalization when it was showing at Stills Gallery in Sydney. Just remind us what you were kind of, what you're working with in that series.
Yeah, so Decookalization looks at the places that are named after Cook as a tribute to him. I was looking at Captain Cook's places that he visited, and I went back through and I checked all the places that were named after him, and all the places were discovered by Indigenous people first, bar Norfolk Island, I think. No, Maori had been to Norfolk Island as well and colonised, but had abandoned it. And other than Antarctica, he's the first human to site Antarctica that we know of, but most places had already been discovered by white people beforehand, and in some cases English people as well. So he really, it was just the fact that the Pacific had been colonized by the British that they started naming stuff after Captain James Cook. So I was interested in that process, and then I, as a process of decolonizing in this stage, Decookalization, I went back through and took his name out and then renamed him with a traditional name, just to really highlight that he wasn't the first person, and who he was is only because he's been put up on a pedestal because the British colonised this area. And that's really it, because in a lot of cases he didn't discover anything. I mean, it's just really odd that he's got these names. He's probably one of the only people in the world to have a whole country named after him, the Cook Islands. So yeah, I wanted to rename places like the Cook Islands with Awainui. Yeah.
Hawaiki is a mythical, well, it's not mythical, it's very much in the memory of Maori people and of many people from what we call the Pacific. What does that word mean to you? Is that a real place?
I guess for me, it's both a, well, I mean, it's not a concept that I grew up with, and it's only something that I've discovered a lot later, but there's always been this feeling of that. And I think that word, when I came across it, I realized that I felt that feeling. And it, for me, it's probably more of a, I don't know, maybe in a sense, a spiritual connection to a place when you don't no longer live there. And it's a beautiful concept, just because it really does, because Polynesian people were so transient through the Pacific, this whole notion that to have connection to a new place, you also need to have a connection to a place beforehand where your ancestors came from before. And it really, I think, it's so relevant in contemporary society now because we move so much and we always feel that disconnect. And you get that a lot through British Australians still feeling a connection to their motherland. And it's a similar connection, but this at the same time as giving you a connection to the place where your ancestors come from, it actually gives you a connection to the physical place that you now live in. And there's other rituals that allow you to do this. So if you were to travel to a new island, you have a kid and you want your child to have a connection to the place, you take the placenta, which is called whenua in Maori, and the ground is also called whenua. So you take the placenta out and you from the newborn baby and you plant it in the new land into the ground, and then the baby then has a connection to this new place. So these concepts about migration that are so relevant now, which can give us so much connection, and it gives me so much connection as a Maori Australian, having a place that my ancestors come from, and I know that I wasn't originally from here, but now I belong here, because it gives me that disconnect by connecting me at the same time.
And interesting, I didn't know the Cook Islands were named after Captain Cook. A whole country. A series of islands.
Yeah, and the Cook Islands is also, some people say that is Hawaiki for Maori. So their Hawaiki is Cook Islands. Now mine is Aotearoa. So mine is now New Zealand. So yeah, it's interesting, and I think slightly offensive to name a whole country after Cook rather than about, you know, such a poetic notion of your homeland, which their traditional name is Awaiki Nui, which is the great land of the ancestors. So it's kind of, I think it's kind of, yeah, really offensive to name it after this colonizer. And, you know, that by calling it that, and lucky that it hasn't been lost in over the time of being westernized, that original name still exists. But if it didn't, that could break a whole link of, you know, Polynesian history and oral language. And that'd be devastating.
James Tyler there speaking with Daniel Browning. And you can see James' photographs if you're in Melbourne. They're at Brightspace in St Kilda, and all the details that you need are on our website. Now, the time is ticking on the Up Late competition. You've got to have your entries in by Sunday, this coming Sunday. So you know now what the whole thing is. It's to do with the Melbourne Writers' Festival. We'd love you to tell us in 100 words or fewer what the theme Up Late means to you. Maybe you like to walk at night. Maybe you're a truckie. I don't know. Maybe you're sitting up at night listening to the show in the wee small hours. Anyway, write us 100 words, or less than 100 words, fewer than 100 words, and you'll be in the running for quite a prize. There's flights for two people to Melbourne. If you're in Melbourne, I don't know what happens, but anyway, there are flights for two to Melbourne, and accommodation in Melbourne, and you go to some events at the Melbourne Writers' Festival, five or six, you get tickets to those, and you'll be there at the opening night event as well. Now, I've been asked if I'll share my own attempt at this, so brace yourself. This is what I wrote in under 100 words. And I should explain the background to this. I went to see this incredible pianist, this Chinese pianist called Yu Jia Wang. And after I go to a concert, I just make some notes in a notebook, because I might have to talk about the work of art later. So I like to capture that feeling I've got straight after the show. And this is exactly what I wrote in my little journal. Tonight, I heard the Chinese pianist Yu Jiangwei play Prokofiev in Hamer Hall, playing like glass raining on a crystal ocean, like a storm hammering on the Russian steppes, and then pirouetting like a bird with sunshine on her wings. At interval, I left the hall and I walked through the city until late. The roads were black and shiny with rain, and all around me lights were dancing in the dark, and God was playing arpeggios across the sky. Well, there you go. That's my modest effort. You could have your modest effort too. In fact, you're an absolute expert on being up late, because here you are, you and I, just as we come up to 3 o'clock in the morning, so very much up late. So you could even capture this moment in under 100 words. All the details are there on the webpage. Just go to our webpage, and on the right-hand side, you'll see a picture of a woman dressed in black holding up a sign, and it says Melbourne Writers' Festival. And if you click on that, a whole window opens up to you, a window on a new world. A window that may lead you to a prize. Now, on our next show, we're going to meet some fiction writers and some artists who are talking about this debate about racism and tolerance in Australia, which has all been brought on by the great controversy around the footballer Adam Goods. So we're going to buy into that on our next show. It's been front page news for 2 weeks, actually. What have artists and writers got to say about that conversation between a racial or a racist Australia, to put it at its harshest, and an Australia which is tolerant and welcoming, a tolerant and welcoming place. We'll talk about that on our next show. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. We're just coming up to the news. I hope you do have a very good night, and we'll talk again tomorrow if you happen to be awake. Bye-bye.